Thank you, counsel. Our final case of the morning will be number 22-11421, McDonough versus Garcia, Wright et al.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alan Greenstein. I represent Dr. James Eric McDonough in this particular case. On August 24th and 9-1 of 2016, we believe we have shown that the City of Homestead and its officers violated my client's rights under the Fourth and First Amendments and under Florida state law. The lower court erred in granting the appellee's motion for summary judgment. The court should have granted our motion for summary judgment, as I think, as a matter of law, we're entitled to that decision. There are three areas in this case. One, the arrest for disorderly conduct. Two, the arrest for cyberstalking. And three, the First Amendment issues. Now, excuse me, since the court asked us to address an issue dealing with the First Amendment, I think I should deal with that initially. The court asked the question about whether or not the exclusion based upon comments he may have made to Councilman Maldonado were content neutral or content based. So let me answer the question this way, if I can. An argument can be made that his exclusion on July 27th, both being stopped and being taken out of the chambers, were content-based. However, I think the exclusion that was made by the trespass order, both by the city and at that time Sergeant Wright, were not worried about what he was going to say. They just didn't want him saying anything, and therefore they excluded him and banned him for an indeterminate period of time so that he could not come back and address the city council, which he had done on many times before.
So is your point then that the trespass order was not so much a punishment for what he had said in the past, that might have been a content-based judgment, but on a going forward basis, they just didn't want him around because he was disruptive and that was a content neutral?
Yes, that appears to be what the evidence shows. I wish I could show you something else, but the evidence seems to indicate that when Sergeant Wright spoke to him, when he came back on the 24th, he said, based on your comments and behavior. And I don't think I have any evidence to show the court that in the discussions that the city manager and the chief of police had, it was based upon his comments about Councilman Maldonado.
I mean, maybe we'll have to ask your adversary about this because it's their brief that tees up this question. They say that the trespass order was based on some mix of things, some of which seemed to go to content, cursing, the perceived threat to Maldonado, one of which, disruptive behavior or whatever it is,
right,
seems to go to something that I would call content neutral.
Right.
I guess I'm not quite sure whether that is sort of retroactive or prospective. Is that a punishment for what he did before, or prospective, sort of like prophylactic?
I'd like to say it was punishment for what he did before in terms of when he yelled and screamed, when he was taken out of the chambers. I can't tell the court, I wish I could, that it was based upon his comments about Councilman Maldonado, because I don't have any evidence of what happened inside the council chambers, of the city manager. As a matter of fact, when we took the deposition of Chief Roll, he had no recollection of even doing this. So we had to piece together what happened based upon other depositions that had been taken in other cases.
Is it more like a time, place, and manner restriction, or if it was based on disruptiveness, is it not even speech related? Is it something else?
It is speech related in that they were not allowing to come back and speak. The district court said this was content neutral. All the cases that I've listed and given the court were based on content neutral. I wish I could tell you it was based upon what he said to Councilman Montanaro, honestly, but I have no evidence of that. The evidence is that they had a meeting. Chief Roll said, we're not letting this guy back in, trespass him. So our position is, even if it's content neutral, they did not have the right to ban him because it is not narrowly tailored to achieve the government's purpose, which was to prevent him from bad behavior.
What would be narrowly tailored? Let's say, we won't even make it your client, right? So you're not giving up anything for him. But okay. Let's say that someone else is just extremely disruptive repeatedly every time, maybe cursing, saying maybe perhaps they're mentally ill, right? They're not even kind of engaging with what the subject matter is. What would be a narrowly tailored way to deal with that?
I expected the court to ask me that question. First of all, let me say, if the court reads the Walsh case, which I gave the court, in that case, basically the judge said, every single time you take him out, you can't prohibit someone from speaking. Now, interestingly, back in 2016, I don't know that they have the tools then that we may have now, where Zoom has become certainly, for example, judge the court, I'm sorry, the city council could say, you can come in, we'll allow you to address the council chamber on Zoom. That way you have the audience, you can hear everything that's being said. Should you be disruptive, we will turn you off. But that might be one. Back in 2016, they could advise that person, if you're disruptive, we are going to exclude you. Now, let me say this. That's not what happened in this case. I understand the court's question. And prospectively, this court doesn't have to decide what should happen to someone should he or she be constantly disruptive. The record evidence shows that my client spoke many numerous times before and had never been disruptive.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
no, go ahead, please.
I know that neither you nor the other side used the term prior restraint. Do you think that this was a prior restraint?
I thought I did use the word prior restraint. If I didn't, yes, it is a prior restraint. They are stopping him from speaking before he is allowed to say anything, and they're not allowed to do that unless it serves some governmental purpose, and they can restrict time, place, and manner, which what in essence the city decided to do was use the ultimate punishment to my client, ban him from speaking.
Can I ask you just a quick question?
Sure.
I mean, it wasn't really a ban, right? I mean, they just said, write us a letter. Did he ever try?
No.
Did he ever write the letter?
No, sir.
Why?
First of all, they didn't tell him who to write the letter to. And if I can say something about that, Judge, the lower court, the district court, said, one of the reasons I'm going to find that this is narrowly tailored is because they gave him a procedure, which is write a letter. Sergeant Wright never told him who to write the letter to, what would happen with the letter. And as a matter of fact, the district court cites Catrone for the idea that you have to give somebody procedure. The procedure in Catrone, which they actually gave somebody a piece of paper, had no further procedure. And this court ruled that that was not an appropriate procedure. There's no way for anybody to know what to do. Additionally, the city council had decided four months earlier that they were going to change the rules of decorum so that no one would be banned anymore. But before April of 2016, they had a provision that the mayor could ban someone if they were disruptive, and they had a procedure as to how you could write the letter. You got to get the city council to agree to let you come back. They changed that and got rid of that decorum policy in April of 2016, 4 months before my client spoke in front of the city council. So there was no procedure. Sergeant Wright made it up. There was no way for him to know who to write the letter to.
When you write the letter to the city council, wouldn't that be?
Maybe, maybe not. But since the city council didn't have a procedure as to what to do, there was no point in him writing a letter.
Did he have any obligation at all to sort of inquire about, like, okay, I'd like to come back. To whom should this letter be written? What should it say? Did he have any obligation at all to kind of engage in the...
No, I don't think he had. He asked, which was more than he probably had to do. They should have provided him an opportunity. In other words, the city should have said, we're banning you. Here is how you can come back. The obligation shouldn't be on the banned person to say, well, wait a second. How do I come back? What am I supposed to do? The obligation should be on the government. They're the ones saying you can't come back.
Now, as I understand your case, you're not challenging the constitutionality of the trespass procedure itself, right?
No.
You're just challenging its application in this situation.
And the result that occurred from it, which was, well...
While he was under a valid trespass order, did he even have a First Amendment right to appear at the meeting?
I don't think it was a valid trespass order. Then maybe I am challenging it based upon the way you're asking it. It wasn't a valid trespass order because it violated the First Amendment law on content-neutral meetings by a city council meeting, which must provide someone. They have to be narrowly tailored. How can the ultimate punishment be narrowly tailored? And second, they have to give him an ample alternative channels of communication, which they did not. There was no way for him to address the city council with the audience, just like in Walsh and in Brown versus Jacksonville, which is I cited. And what I said in my briefs is this court is obviously not bound by those cases. They're district court cases. Walsh was from Oregon. But they're the only cases I could find that address the fact that someone was banned from speaking in front of the city council based upon their prior behavior. And as a matter of fact, there's a Sixth Circuit case, Polaris, that says you can't prohibit somebody's First Amendment rights based upon their prior behavior. So I see my time is up.
Hang on. I'm sorry. I'm not going to let you off the hook.
That's fine.
I've just got sort of more I need to explore.
Please.
And so, like Judge Pryor said, if we hold you on, you're not eating into your rebuttal.
Okay.
So one more question on the First Amendment piece. Even if we're in content-neutral land, and you've been talking a lot about narrow tailoring.
Yeah.
What exactly is the important or substantial government interest here? I mean, and was it infringed? I mean, I get it that they have an interest in ensuring that the meetings are not disrupted.
Right.
But I mean, I don't know, the meeting went on. Like, I've watched the video.
No, the meeting...
Your guy is being escorted out. The next guy just steps up and starts talking.
Right.
And
I didn't even get into that, but you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you. I mean, their interest, I believe, was in making sure that their meetings proceed and they didn't want disruption. But as Your Honor said, Judge Newsom, the meeting did go on. I think, as a matter of fact, the next speaker didn't even hesitate to speak. I think a couple of people in the back turned around. So, I understand what their interest was, but in this case, unlike some of the other cases that I cited, those people were disruptive as they were speaking. They were told to stop or something like that. This occurred outside the council chambers, and I don't think that banishment served the governmental purpose, as the court points out. The meeting went on.
So can I ask you a question about the disorderly conduct arrest?
Sure.
I'll just be coarse. It's about the crotch grab, the alleged crotch grab.
Yes.
Two questions, I guess. One, sort of factually, I've watched the video. I can't see it. I don't see a crotch grab. But hasn't your guy acknowledged that the officer might reasonably have thought he witnessed a crotch grab, and under the sort of the probable cause analysis, isn't that what his reasonable belief is what we're concerned about, not about sort of what actually happened?
Let me answer two ways. One, I happen to agree with the court. I didn't see it. And if the court looks at the video, the court needs to ask itself, is it possible that Sergeant Wright could have seen a crotch grab? And the answer is no. In fairness to my client, I don't think he was right. I think he was trying to be overly fair at his deposition. And by the way, the word he used was possible. But if the judges, you take a look at the video, he just keeps walking. There is no crotch grab. And even if he touched, as he's walking, touched his genital area fully clothed, that still is not disorderly conduct.
So that's my next question. Is it a matter of law? What's the difference between the middle finger and a crotch grab? Why is the middle finger not disorderly conduct, but suddenly the crotch grab is? I don't think I understand. Maybe I don't
understand well enough. I'm not saying it is.
Gestures communicate. Well, no, I'm asking, is there a legal distinction between what those two things communicate?
No, not under this circumstance. If my client had done more than give the finger, and even assuming he grabbed his crotch, had done more to incite other people, then I would say yes. But in this case, if you just, and I don't mean to belabor this, but if you grab your crotch and leave, you haven't done anything wrong. Maybe people don't want to behave that way, but that's not against the law. And that's basically what they're saying. It's more than words. He grabbed his crotch. But if you look at the video, it's clear he did not. And my client, I believe, was being overly generous to when he answered that question.
I tend to agree with you that I don't see a difference. But what about the standard that we're looking at? Is it possible that the officer could have let's assume that there was a crotch grab, which I know you're not, but is it possible that the officer could have thought that there was some special thing about a crotch grab that gave him probable cause?
No. First of all, possible crotch grab. But second, even if he did it, that's not disorderly conduct.
And can I ask you a question about that? Because you mentioned the word incitement a minute
yes.
ago. I've read the underlying Florida cases on this disorderly conduct, and they all do seem to say that absent some actual incitement of people, it's not disorderly conduct.
Yes.
But I'll have to confess, that just seems a little weird to me that a police officer should have to await the actual breach of the peace before there's disorderly conduct instead of anticipate like, oh boy, this is escalating, this could reasonably result in an incitement, I need to nip this now.
And that would be fine if he nipped it.
I have no
problem with him nipping it.
But
I have a problem with him arresting it to nip him. You could say, Dr. McDonough, please, you're about to do something, please leave. All right. We can live with that.
I see. But,
his nipping was arresting
him for the crime of disorderly conduct.
Exactly.
There has to be actual incitement.
There has to be actual incitement. And then the district court judge added the fact that they had had an interaction 28 days before, and he thought something was going to happen when the clear facts of the case indicate that nothing was happening. He walked away. He wasn't giving anybody any problems. He followed every order of Sergeant Wright. Every order, and left the scene, and there was nobody there to incite. So I see my time is up. Thank you. I've reserved some time for rebuttal. Thanks.
Yes, you'll have your time for rebuttal. You are answering the court's questions. Mr. Geddes.
Good morning. May it please the court. Edward Geddes on behalf of the appellees, officers Garcia, Wright, and the City of Homestead. With me at council table are Matthew Mandel and Ann Flanagan, who were counsel of record in the district court. Unless the court prefers to take it in a different order, I'd like to start with the First Amendment issue. My friend on the other side seems to acknowledge that we're not dealing with a content-based scenario
here. So what's your position on that? Because, I mean, I'll confess, it was language in your brief characterizing the decision-making process that sort of tipped me off to this potential problem. So what do you mean when you say the decision was based on these three things, two of which seem to me to go to the content of the speech?
It's a fair observation, Judge Newsom. When I went back and reread the brief, I thought, we really didn't need to say that, because what we were trying to point out, we were merely describing what happened at the prior council meeting, and we were just being factually correct. It was never intended that the trespass was issued because of what was said, either to Councilman Maldonado or as he was leaving the council chambers, or even after he left the council chambers and was still in City Hall. So I can understand why the way we phrased it might have created that perception, but we were merely describing the behavior that happened at that meeting. And that's what we come back to, this notion that the trespass order was based upon behavior and not so much what was said. And I would draw attention to the fact
cursing,
that...
Do you think, and I haven't looked to see if cases have decided this, so maybe the answer is obvious, but I'm not confident that cursing is content anyway, because, for instance, there are a lot of words for human excrement, some of which are cursing and some of which you teach your two-year-old. So does that, is that really about content or more about behavior?
Oh, it's more about behavior. There's no question. And it's context that matters. We're in the middle of a city council meeting.
So just so I'm clear, does that mean that if you can say, hypothetically, if you say to one of our councilmen, go fly a kite, it's fine. But if you say, go F yourself, we're going to take you out. That's not content-based?
If that were the distinction that was drawn in this case, I would say there's a problem there. But that's not what happened here. I just think that in a certain context, if after Mr. McDonough, Dr. McDonough, was asked to leave the podium, and as he's being escorted out, he's cursing up a storm, he's no longer speaking to the council. This is just, I don't want to use the terminology, but it's a series of expletives. And Your Honor said you watched the video. You see the reactions of some of the people wondering, it's like, you know, what's that?
I thought they were quite muted. I was surprised by how muted the reactions were. It seemed to me like the meeting just kind of went on. People were like, oh, that maybe they even
thought accustomed to it, right?
Yeah,
And that's a sad commentary on where we are in public discourse, perhaps. But that's neither here nor there. I think it's interesting, and it bears maybe some discussion. My friend on the other side said, well, there's no case law addressing this. And respectfully, I think there is. And it's this court's decision, an unpublished decision, as it were. But the decision in 2021, just a few months before NetChoice and Austin, in Dyer and the Atlanta School District. The facts are remarkably similar.
To be fair, though, unpublished cases are not case law.
At least I understand. And that's why I wanted to disclose to
the court. So what was it that you found persuasive about the analysis in that case, rather than just similar to this case?
Well, what was persuasive about the case was that in a scenario where a participant at a school board meeting, a community meeting, which is open to the public, somebody was very disruptive. And the end result of that was that the school district issued a trespass order, the effective equivalent of a trespass order. It was issued by the police department. It was the school saying, you shall not only not appear at a community meeting of the school district, you shall not go anywhere on school board property, any district property. You are not out for 1 year based upon your behavior at that community meeting.
Right, so that's what happened, right? But what's persuasive to you about why that was allowed to happen?
Because the court concluded that ultimately that kind of a restriction was a content-neutral one that justified the district's interest in the orderly conduct of public meetings. And that's what we have here.
And so, but to follow up on Judge Grant's point, I mean, like, so one level deeper, and I don't even remember the case if I've read it, so you'll have to help me, but, like, what's the analysis? The court said that justified the school district's interest. Why? Like, what was the compelling governmental interest, or whatever, the substantial government interest? What was the narrow tailoring? I think we're just trying to figure out, because it's unpublished, like, is it the sort of thing that is worthy of our attention? It can't just be the result, I guess.
I understand, Your Honor, and I apologize. I'm going to find the... The district court granted AIS the district's motion for summary judgment on both remaining constitutional claims. For the First Amendment claim, the district court found that the district's restrictions on Dyer were content neutral, and as the district cut off Dyer's speech because he expressed himself in a hostile manner that disrupted the meeting progress. That's the court's description. And then the court, in its analysis, says, apologize. A content-neutral ordinance is one that places no restrictions on either particular viewpoint or any subject matter that may be discussed. Here, the district board policies outlining how someone may speak at a community meeting, prohibiting disruption and requiring decorum, are content-neutral policies. We agree with the district court's determination that the district did not regulate Dyer's speech based on its content because it was offensive. Rather, they regulated Dyer's offensive speech because it was disruptive. That's where they...
Why why wouldn't the appropriate thing to do be, and I'm not familiar with that case either, but why wouldn't the appropriate thing to be if a speaker is disruptive, then they're removed, rather than telling a speaker who's been disruptive in the past that they may never speak again? Those are different, right?
Certainly, but then the question became, and this was part of the process that the city went through, they tried to determine, well, is there a trespass order that can issue subsequent to the actual event? And they inquired of the assistant state attorney's the state attorney's office. They got a go-ahead, yes, you can do it after the fact. And the discussion, even among command staff, was, well, you know, we had this prior disruption. We want to avoid it from occurring again. And I think part of what...
I get wanting to avoid it. I'm less certain that you can under the First Amendment. I'm less certain that you don't need to wait for him to become disruptive again and then escort him out again. And time after time after time. And I, too, would be very frustrated if I were on the city council and this kept happening. I don't think it's a very good way to behave. But I'm not confident that you can just say you can't come to this public meeting again because you've been disruptive at past public meetings.
Well, I mean, Your Honor, what we went by, the available case law, that, and I understand it's an unpublished decision, we keep coming back to how this very court just a few months earlier reasoned that it was appropriate to take that step precisely because, in that case, the district couldn't know when the next flare-up would be.
Did the court in that case consider less restrictive alternatives, the repeated removals, as Judge Grant refers to, or the teleconferencing option that your adversary refers to? I mean, it does seem like there are off-ramps between nothing and a bar.
Well, I mean, this wasn't and I know there's disagreement with my friend on the other side, but this isn't an absolute bar, all right? This is, you cannot come back to, and actually it was, you cannot come back to City Hall, because part of the conduct was not just in council chambers during the council meeting. It was also what occurred outside of council chambers, still within City Hall, which is the constant escalation, the antagonism that was happening. And the decision was, you can't come back unless you write to the city and get permission to do so. The idea being, it's a cooling off period.
Can I ask you a quick question? Can you give me the cite for that case?
Certainly, Your Honor. It is, I apologize, the glasses are great for looking, but not for reading up close.
We're all there.
Yeah.
There. 852, Federal Appendix, 397.
Thanks.
Sure.
Can I ask, while you're at a pause, can I ask you sort of like a macro question? To what extent, taking a few steps back, should I be concerned, I'll speak for myself, should I be concerned that this seems to me like the absolute core of what the First Amendment is about? Political speech, sort of petitioning in some modern sense, the government for a redress of grievances, isn't this like absolutely what the First Amendment's like essence is? Participatory democracy? I realize this was coarse, it's not my bag, it's not how I talk, but that being said, this is participatory democracy and it's messy.
At a macro level, as Your Honor pointed out, I agree. The issue of political discourse, the coming to a city council meeting and expressing your views on a subject, is certainly at the core. But the fact that it's at the core doesn't mean that there cannot be rules of decorum.
But it means that we should be wary, doesn't it? I mean, this isn't new dancing, right? This is...
I understand. I understand, and I'm not suggesting to the court in any way that it should just shrug its shoulders and say, so what? What's the big deal? I understand that the trespass order related to going to City Hall. But given the undisputed facts that we have here regarding the behavior that happened, we're past the point that what is being regulated is not the political speech or an attempt to regulate the political speech, but to prevent certain types of behavior. So let's put it this way. If instead of the appellant having left the stand and started screaming, Mary had a little lamb, her fleece was white as snow, and started in some crazed recitation of nursery rhymes, the disruption would have occurred either way. And in fact, it's interestingly enough, the Florida Supreme Court in the White case, when looking at what constitutes disorderly conduct, in that case drew that exact same example, which involved an individual who shows up at a police station insisting upon the release of his father, who's in custody, and loses it. And the court says it's not about what the individual was saying, what he was saying, it's how it was being said and in the context of how it was being said, which in that case, and that's when the court said, if he had been screaming Mary had a little lamb at the top of his lungs, the issue would have been the same.
So, I mean, that arguably gets you to content neutral, but you've still got to wrangle with the standard that applies if we're applying some version of intermediate scrutiny, right? And so now we're back to Judge Grant's question and my question and your adversary's position about successive takeouts or teleconferencing or whatever, like, you know, options short of a presumptive ban.
Well, in part, and this is, I'm not aware of any case law, all right? And again, in this circuit or at the Supreme Court level, that has indicated that in a situation where you have disruptive behavior in a government-conducted proceeding, that you're required to consider as a less narrow or a less stringent matter, you have to let it happen again. Because there's something fundamentally wrong with the notion that and this sort of gets to the question of what would be narrower? Well, one possible solution is, okay, we're going to let you come back in and we'll cross our fingers, maybe it doesn't happen again. And I just don't see, I'm not aware of any case law that says that you have to do that. When you have the behavior and it's documented and you're worried about it happening at the very next meeting.
Had he been escorted out? Had this sort of thing happened before?
The record doesn't reflect that it had.
Are you aware?
Personally, no, I am not. So I can't speak to it, and I don't want...
So anyway, so far as we know, this is the first time this has happened. And I don't know, it doesn't seem that big an ask to me if, as we take the case, this is the first time this has happened, that some sort of like admonition, hey, that was ugly last time, don't do that again. No more cursing, no more talking to individual commissioners. Mind your P's and Q's. And then if he violates that one, take him out again. Maybe the next time it's a teleconference, you mute him. If he keeps doing it, then you ban him, or some version of that. But here you kind of just went like straight to the nuclear option.
I can't dispute those facts. I would point out that I'm not aware in the record where that was the contention made below, that there were these other options available to the city. It was just this notion, well, you've banned him. And the problem with the ban is that you haven't told him how to avoid it, how to get out of it, which is really a procedural due process claim, which also was not asserted below. So would it be possible? Yes. I'd be lying to the court if I didn't say it was a possibility. But under this record, and under the available case law, I'm not aware that there is that requirement. I'm sorry, Judge Grant, it seemed like you were about to ask a question.
Well, I'm just shifting gears a little bit. To go to the disorderly conduct issue, do you think that crotch grabbing is different than giving the bird?
I think, actually, I never thought I'd find myself
in
the United States Court of Appeals arguing the distinctions between giving the bird and crotch grabbing. But I do think there's a difference. At least certainly from the perspective of the officer who was on the scene. When somebody, this seems odd.
Just say it.
But
that's
somebody, fair. We're
when
we're
somebody
good.
Flips a bird, it's directed at someone. right? If I were to do that to the court, heaven forbid, you would certainly take it as a statement that I was making to you. A crotch grab has other implications. Again, I can't cite to an authority on crotch grabbing, but keep in mind that what happened here, at least from the perspective of the officers, is that there were other people in City Hall coming in and out of City Hall who might have observed not so much the flipping of the bird to Sergeant Wright, but grabbing the crotch.
What does that make it? Incitement? And if so, incitement of what? Like a mass of crotch grabbing? I don't really know what would be incited.
Flash mob.
It's not a question of incitement. And again, I'm not convinced that the case law is clear under Florida state law that incitement is always required, because then I come back to the White decision from the Florida Supreme Court, which was the individual who went to the police station to get his father released and just because he was emotionally upset, lost it and started behaving really, really irrationally and yelling. And the court concluded that was disorderly conduct, even though there wasn't an incitement to riot or an incitement to physical danger. It was just precisely how the behavior was occurring in the context of a police station.
So we've talked about the sort of the any potential legal distinction between finger shooting or bird shooting and crotch grabbing.
Right.
Sort of the what those two things express or don't express. What about the factual piece of this? I mean, like, I've watched the video. Can you find the crotch grab in that video from any angle? I mean, you've probably watched it 1,000 times. I've watched it 5 times. But I just can't find it. I can't figure out when it would have happened. The officer's testimony is that he grabbed his crotch as he was shooting the bird. You can see when he emerges from the pillar, he then goes to shoot the bird. That lasts for like 3 or 4 seconds, and he's definitely not grabbing his crotch then. No doubt about it.
All I can point out to is that I can't put myself in Sergeant Wright's position, which is where we all need to put ourselves in, the position of a reasonable officer in the moment with the knowledge that he has in the context that it occurs. And I can't say definitively that Sergeant Wright might not have perceived it. And in fact, and I know my friend on the other side says that the appellant was being generous. I don't know where the generosity comes.
We look at that in the same way as if an officer said, I saw someone brandish a knife and it turned out to be a cell phone. Is that the same sort of thing? Like maybe the officer thought that there was a crotch grab even if there wasn't one? Or are you making a different kind of argument?
Well, no. I mean, there is that question of perception from the arresting officer's viewpoint, which is, to use your example, is it utterly unreasonable for a police officer to think that a cell phone might be a knife or that it might be some kind of a weapon? No.
But then I guess if you see a cell phone, then you might think, oh, well, maybe the officer thought that was a knife. But what if you see nothing on the video and the officer says, I thought I saw him brandish a knife? Is that different?
Well, hindsight is 20/20. Right, we collectively have the luxury of calmly watching a video and making a determination, well, is that reasonable to have concluded that based upon what was seen? But at the moment when the appellant had been just given his trespass order and he turns around and begins behaving in a manner that was reminiscent of what Sergeant Wright observed at the council meeting, the yelling, the screaming, the threatening, the foul language, and then he, according to Sergeant Wright, perceives that there was a crotch grab in the presence of other people in City Hall. Is it appropriate from a probable cause determination to say, well, after the fact, if you view the video, that probably wasn't the right call? But Sergeant Wright didn't have the benefit of the video. He was in the moment, having just ordered somebody to leave, and as that person is leaving, he's seeing a repetition of the behavior of which he knows. And again, under this court's precedent, when looking at that analysis, you do consider the knowledge the officer had at the time of making the arrest. So
I can't recall. Was there a crotch grab at the meeting?
No, there wasn't a crotch grab. I'm not aware of any prior instances of crotch grabbing. I see that I am.
Well, hold on. I'm sorry.
He's like, please let me sit.
No,
down.
No. I'm just worried. I see the blinking red light, sorry. And I'm at 7.5 minutes. But as long as the court has questions,
I want to ask you one question about the cyber stalking arrest. Mm-hmm. We haven't really touched on that yet. So as I read the district court's opinion, it says that the cyber stalking arrest, the probable cause to arrest on that was based on three things. One, him calling, or you know, this maybe this is from your brief, sort of echoing the district court. One, him calling Monaco a coward, right? Two, that he thought he had been threatened with retaliation, or that he threatened retaliation. I'm sorry, that McDonough threatened retaliation, and three, that he threatened to blast the address out.
Correct. His home address.
Take those one by one. So surely calling someone a coward is not disorderly conduct. Cyber stalking.
That's my question.
Yeah.
No, I...
So just kind of factor that out.
Right. I would not say
second that. Piece of it, that McDonough threatened retaliation. I thought McDonough said that he thought he had been threatened with retaliation.
My focus on the question of the cyber stalking, because all the statute requires is that there be this fear that arises from the conduct that occurs, and
so
in
you're
this
focused on the blasting.
Absolutely, okay. It is revealing or threatening to reveal to the public a police officer's home address.
Now, so here's my question: how is that revelatory if the police officer himself has already gone public with his own address? Like there's a video online of him saying into the mic, leaning in and saying, here's my home address.
Right, but respectfully, Your Honor, he might have disclosed his home address to the state of Florida to get a driver's license. There are any number of different...
But I mean, would that be publicly available for all to see?
I don't know, but the point is that what the appellant was threatening was not just because he does it twice, right? Which is once he includes a link in the very first post to a YouTube video. And that YouTube video is where Officer Monaco appeared at the public meeting, right? And then at the end, he then subsequently says, I'm going to blast that information. It's probably a safe assumption for us to say that the vast majority of people, and again, I'm speculating here, do not spend 24 hours a day searching YouTube videos to find home addresses for police officers. But the appellant was going to make it a point to disclose it, to send it out. And I think it's almost self-evident why a police officer would be worried for himself and for his family that his home address was going to be blasted to somebody who is antagonistic to him.
Actually, I take your point on that. I mean, I wouldn't want my home address is out there. I wouldn't want it blasted out. But what about whether this was repeated? Didn't this happen? This interaction happened in a really short time frame. And I think cyber stalking generally requires. If I think of stalking, I think of that as taking a period of time. If you do one bad thing to someone, that's not stalking. But if you kind of show up at their house once a week or creepily follow them around a lot, right, that is stalking, and that gets at the repeated part of the test. But how is this repeated?
Okay. I'm going to read what the statute actually says. It defines the term course of, this is 784.0481B. It says course of conduct means a pattern of conduct composed of a series of acts over a period of time, however short, which evidences a continuity of purpose. Okay?
Was this a series of acts over a period of time?
Our contention is that the posts which culminated in the I'm going to blast your home address, was the last of a number of posts that occurred in however short a period of time that, and I'm gonna use the language that's used, you're a giant twat, you know, you're a coward, you're a liar. There were a series of personalized insults that then culminate in I'm going to reveal your home address to the public.
These timing issues are really hard. I mean, the Supreme Court has looked at this in a different context over, you know, how do you determine whether it's a series of criminal events or one kind of course of conduct that's one criminal event. And I think one, speaking only for myself, I have a hard time necessarily, I think it's close as to whether this was all one incident that took place over a period of hours or whether it was a series of incidents that took place.
I don't think this has to be measured in any context other than the statutory context under Florida law, right? And in this instance, the Florida legislature gave us a definition, and it took pains. I mean, it's interesting. The legislature could have said, course of conduct means a pattern of conduct composed of a series of acts over a period of time, which evidences a continuity of purpose. But they didn't. They added, however, short.
What's your closest Florida case to these facts?
There isn't one, Your Honor. I wish I
sorry, that wasn't a trick question. I just wanted to make
no, sure. No, I understand it. And this is not a statute that has an abundance of case law associated with it. It's the one case I am aware of, which is the CRAPAX decision from the Fourth District Court of Appeal, seems to say, well, we're going to treat 4 hours worth of taggings as a single instance, right? So I concede that is out there. But I think the difference between CRAPAX and here is, in the facts of CRAPAX, the tagging was a reversible event. In other words, if I get tagged, I go on Facebook and I can untag myself and the episode's done. These postings by the appellant are permanent. There's no evidence in the record anywhere along the way that the appellant intended to take them down, that they weren't going to be available to every single person who visited leoaffairs.com. And every time somebody would go on leoaffairs.com, they would see this over and over and over again, and which we contend is the continuity of purpose, because the appellant knew that he controlled these posts entirely and that they would stay there as long as he wanted them to stay there. So this isn't quite, in our view, CRAPAX. And I would also add, with some due respect to the 4th DCA, I don't think the 4th DCA's conclusion about the 4 hours being a single instance is grounded in the statutory language. Because the statutory language does, in fact, say, however short. So the court has been very generous with its time, and I appreciate that. Unless the court has any other questions, we would respectfully request that the court affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Greenstein, you'll have your full time that you reserve for rebuttal.
By the way, I forgot to introduce my client is here, James Eric McDonough. He's sitting in the audience. Judge, let me first address the disorderly conduct. Everyone's viewed the video. It's quite obvious that my client did not grab his crotch, and if we're going to discuss this, let's just make this clear. It's our position, and I put this in my brief, that Sergeant Wright was not being exactly truthful. I think he was embellishing to make sure the disorderly conduct arrest could stand. That's why he put in his report about the fact that there were four women and children, there were people coming in and out. If the court looks at the video, One person is coming in, two women are going out, and they're not even looking at what's going on. So there's no evidence that he grabbed his crotch. And I cited a case, and honestly, I don't remember the name of the case. The court doesn't have to believe the officer just because he says it. You can use your own eyes and ears as to what happened.
Different case. Let's say that in a different meeting, a different client was angry that they had been thrown out and repeatedly grabbed his crotch and made other vile motions at the officer, and kind of it was not kind of a, you know, see you later situation. It was more of a harassment. Would that qualify as disorderly conduct?
No.
Why not?
That's just lewd behavior. We don't want people behaving like that. Because, Judge, part of disorderly conduct requires an incitement to get other people to do things. Now, if, for example, he grabbed his crotch constantly, and there were people gathering, and then he said to all these people, look at these effing police officers. We got to do something about that. You know, maybe then. But disorderly conduct is what we want to make sure, and what Saunders basically said, Saunders versus State, is we don't want to punish people for the words they use. That's the First Amendment. Now, grabbing your crotch isn't the First Amendment, but maybe it describes a first, just like giving the bird, it describes words. And let me say this. The court courts don't need to assume that something's going to happen in the future. In this case, all we have is one incident where even if he did grab his crotch, nothing happened. And I think the court can limit its decision, its opinion, to that one fact. We don't have to go beyond, well, we have to worry about what if he does it all the time. We don't have to worry about that. The same thing with the First Amendment. In this case, this is the first, no other incidents ever happened as far as the record is concerned, nor do I know of any. So now, on one time, as Judge Newsom said, they took the nuclear option. The court doesn't need to go beyond that and say, well, what happens if someone is disruptive all the time? Let me address
one question.
And sure.
Maybe it's housekeeping. We haven't talked about it yet today, but it is a position that you have raised in your brief. Garcia?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
I have a hard time with the Garcia.
I can understand that, but the court needs to understand, and the reason that he is responsible for the arrest, the physical detainment, and I hope I made that clear in my brief, is just one step of an arrest. As I said in my brief, because it's a misdemeanor, they didn't have to take him to jail. They did not have to do that. They could give him a promise to appear, which does happen, and then he's let go, said, we'll see you in court. That's fine. But the physical detainment, what Sergeant Garcia then did is write the arrest form, and that's the thing that keeps him in jail. If the court, I don't know how familiar you are with what goes on here in Miami-Dade County. We have one example with Judge Glazer, is you come in front of a bond hearing. The judge reads, the affidavit is sworn to. If there's no probable cause, you're released. If there is probable cause, you can be held on some sort of bond or recognizance, whatever it is. So it's more than just simply being detained. Okay, I'm stopped, I'm detained. But Garcia's the one that made it so that he could would stay in jail pending being taken before a magistrate. And that's what happened. So that's why it's important. I couldn't find a case on that directly, but the court needs to think of the fact that this is more than just physical detainment. Stop, you're under arrest. Now, the arrest form's the key thing that keeps him in custody. Without that, he has to be released. No, there's nothing.
Had he already been taken to the jail before Garcia got involved?
No. No. The jail won't take him without the arrest form. I mean, that's not part of the record. I'm just telling you, I've been practicing criminal defense.
He's detained outside, yes. Physically detained outside. Garcia's not on the scene yet, but Garcia comes out. He's the junior officer, and he writes up the arrest warrant. Well,
yes. I don't know if junior is the correct word. He's certainly not a scene. He's not the supervisor on the scene. But anyway, yes.
But he gets tasked with writing the report.
Yes.
And your contention is the report is what lands your client in jail.
That's what lands him in jail. Not only lands him in jail, that keeps him in jail. Keeps him in jail. And as a matter of fact, he went to jail. You're allowed to bond out. They have standard bonds, and he bonded out. He did not end up in front of a in front of a magistrate on that particular incident. He did on the cyber stalking. But that's the thing that would make you come in front of a magistrate, and the jail will not take you without that arrest form. They're just not going to take you. Let me address something. I see my time's up, so I don't want to go on unless the court has any questions. I wanted to address the cyber stalking. I don't know if the court... No?
I think we've got your argument.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Judge. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.